This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, it is 5:31. I am calling this meeting to order. Today is April 12th, 2021. Thank you all for coming today to our second to last meeting of the GPSA in the spring semester. Before I begin with a few announcements, I would like to take this very unique moment to take a moment of silence for the passing of our fellow student, Sean West, whose recent death has greatly affected our entire community. If you could please remain silent for a few moments. Okay, thank you very much. For announcements today, before we begin the roll call, first I would like to note that under our charter, we would normally have elections for voting members in this meeting. However, due to some the relatively unique circumstances that we're facing, we would like to propose a resolution. There's a resolution for our consideration today, which would allow us to have an open election for voting members between now and our next meeting on May 3rd. So please keep in mind that that's the reason why normally we would have that election under the division breakout section of today's meeting. But if this resolution is adopted, we would have basically an online period of elections for voting members. But if that resolution is not adopted, then we will have to go into division breakout in order for the graduate school divisions to elect new voting members. Okay. This is just for the graduate school divisions, not for the professional schools. Okay. My second note is that in our final meeting of the semester, which is on May 3rd, we will be having internal elections for our several positions, the first of which is the officers, which includes the president, the vice president, the vice president of communications, and the vice president of operations. So these four constitute the executive committee. And this is, I think, very important because this will be a term which begins in the end of the semester and continues through the end of the next academic year. So the next set of elections which will happen is a position for our representative to the general committee of the graduate school, which is the administrative, legislative, and judicial board of the graduate school and approves revisions to the code of legislation, approves appointments to the graduate faculty, and makes recommendations for new advanced degrees. So any graduate and professional student is eligible to run for that position as well. Next, we'll be electing the chairs to the standing committees except for appropriations and finance. So that includes DISC, faculty teaching, programming, and student advocacy. And then last, we will elect four new university assembly representatives whose terms will begin at the beginning of the fall next year. Okay, so a lot of internal elections for next meeting, but hopefully if anyone is interested or they have any questions, please feel free to contact me directly. My net ID is DD567. That's DD567, or you're welcome to contact anyone on the executive committee. And we're happy to answer any questions about the responsibilities of being an officer or any of these other positions. And I think we're also planning to send out a sheet to everyone, including the details of each of these positions, as well as the estimated time commitment each week. So please keep that on your radar. This is very important. Okay, so does anyone have any general questions about that right now that I can answer? Please raise your hand if that's the case. Okay, if not, you're welcome to contact me later. So at that, let's now move on to the roll call for today.
Kantar?
Here.
Jack Levin?
Here.
Matthew Bulch?
Here.
Hannah Cole?
Here.
Stephanie Lopez?
Here.
Paul Vinage?
Here.
Martin Chatterjee.
Here.
Maddie.
Here.
Tim Littermoser.
Here.
Jordan Doxel. Cody Duell.
Here.
Casey Laurent.
Here.
Chris O'Connor.
Here.
Hannah Bittiger Curtis.
Here.
Ruth Berinkovich. Bridget Hayes.
Here.
Meredith Welch.
Here.
Charlie Day. Chris Inklin.
Here.
Natalie Gonzalez.
Here.
Chen Lu.
Here.
Christina Inewa.
Here.
Ryan Maloney. Amanda Cirillo. Alexandra Pressure. Matthew
here,
Drescher.
Sorry.
Matthew Drescher. Nick Danev.
Here. Also, let the record show that Charlie Day is here. He messaged in the chat.
Oh, yeah, apologies. Just missed the mute button there.
Akarsha Pandey.
Here.
Kavya Krishnan.
Here.
Caroline Steingart.
Here.
And David Kent. We have 25 voting members present.
All right, thank you. We have quorum for today. Our next item of business is the approval of the meeting minutes for Monday, March 29th, 2021. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Okay, is there a second to approving the minutes as they now stand?
Second.
All right, second. Are there any amendments? Any discussion? Okay, any objection? If not, we'll adopt them by unanimous consent. Okay, seeing none, the minutes are hereby approved. And we'll now move on to presentations for today. Our first presenter is Zebediah Hall, who is Director of Student Disability Services. You are recognized. Thank you for coming.
Not a problem at all, and happy to be in space and time with everyone. I'll just say this, I don't necessarily have a formal presentation as much as I want to open up the dialogue for a question and opportunity to talk around how we can navigate accommodations for our graduate students and our professional students. I think sometimes there's a misunderstanding that sometimes you can get accommodations in undergrad, but then you can't get them in graduate school or in professional schools. And I think it takes the opportunity for students to reach out to Student Disability Services and figure out how we can navigate accommodations, whether that's during your research, whether that's while you're in the lab, whether that's in professional settings and those kind of things. Our office do handle accommodations for all students, whether you're in the law school, whether you're in other professional schools, whether you're at Medical WOW, whether you're at Cornell Tech. There's not a program that Student Disability Services do not service. I will be the first to say in our space, we don't service enough graduate students. Some of that might be because of the culture and the professional settings and some of those other things. And then some of it might not be that students understand that they can actually receive accommodations in these settings. Another thing to think about is we also accommodate the whole educational experience. And so, for example, if there were students that was in this space and time and they needed an interpreter to actually participate in this event, they can work through Student Disability Services to receive accommodations and those kind of things. I really don't want to do a whole lot of talking as much as I want to be able to respond to some of the specific questions that people have. But what I want to do is open up the dialogue to realize there are times where we have accommodated students throughout their dissertation process. There are times where we have accommodated students in their clinical rotations. There are times where we have accommodated students in professional settings and through all of our graduate programs. So I do want to just open that up for the people that don't understand that dynamic. I'll stop talking a little bit and just see if we have any questions. And then if not, I can just keep talking about different things that are on my mind that I want you guys to know.
Okay, thank you. Is there any questions or comments for Zebediah?
Yeah, I have a question. Sorry, I can't raise my hand.
Okay, go ahead, Mark.
So, Zebediah, what do you mean by accommodations and what lies under the umbrella of accommodations?
What I mean by accommodations is not to think about it, I guess, from a standpoint of diagnosis, but think about it from a standpoint of major life functions being compromised, hearing, thinking, learning, seeing, care for oneself. If those kind of things are compromised, you can come to Student Disability Services to put accommodations in place. I think that sometimes we think about it from a long-term standpoint, but also we have a duty to accommodate for temporary accommodations and things like that. What those accommodations look like is varied for different programs. I can give you some examples. Sometimes if people have an A exam or a Q exam and there are medical things going on, sometimes we work with the program to extend their exam or move their exam. If they're actually struggling to participate in taking an exam itself, we will then figure out what's the logistics of that exam, how we can give research, give access to that exam. If students are doing a certain kind of research and they need access to that research, depending on what's going on, we might be able to get their material in an alternative format and those things, if they need their books or their research in an attainable situation. I think it also shows up in lab, depending on how the lab is going. We might need to work with the person that's the director of that lab to see about schedules and how the schedule works with the lab. It's so varied in what we can actually do. It really depends on the student, the health condition, and the specific program that they're in. I can keep rattling off all the different kind of accommodations that we might be able to give, but the main thing is to engage with us. And not engage with us by thinking that you cannot receive accommodations. I think that's the biggest message that I want to send. It really depends on your situation and your condition and how your health is affecting you, but it also depends on the program and where you're at within that program as well.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? You can keep your hand raised if you have any.
Well, I'll just say too, as we're waiting on other questions, there's times where specific accommodations don't necessarily manifest, but there are times where we have set with the chair of your committee or the advisors of your committee to help you figure out accommodations and things like that, or help them figure out better ways to which engage with students. Sometimes we might have students that are on the autistic spectrum, and engaging with those individuals sometimes are a little different. And so sometimes we work with the chair or the committee to figure out how can we communicate in a way that that student can access that material so they can participate fully and things like that. So those are other ways in which we can engage with some of those spaces as well. I do see a hand up.
Yeah, go ahead, Kavya.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, I just had a question. I know at the start of this pandemic, SDS was under a lot of, like, you had to handle all these accommodations coming in from students that wanted to not be physically, that didn't have to physically be on campus. You guys did a great job. I'm curious now, as we're moving back to campus, what issues are you anticipating? And like, how is SDS going to cope with that, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, and when you say come back, are you meaning in the summer, in the fall? Is that what you're...
Right, I mean, I guess we still don't know that, but I know there's already the assumption that fall classes will happen in person. It looks like we might be transitioning back to research in person over the summer, and I know graduate students, many of us are on campus during the summer under normal circumstances. So, but obviously of course the pandemic isn't over yet, so.
Yeah, it really depends on what the university decides on. And from where the university decides, it's then our job to figure out accommodations for those students that reach out to our office on a case-by-case basis. So it really depends on the program. So if the program are given access in various ways, we will tap into those ways to give access. one of the things that I think about from this standpoint is sometimes the questions that we get that if we go in person, will there be virtual options and things like that? I think one of the things that's important to know that if the university decide that we're going to be an in-person campus, from a legal standpoint, it might not be reasonable to have a virtual option that's completely from a, if we're just talking a legal standpoint. But I think I'm less concerned about do we have a virtual option as much as I'm concerned about universal design and how can you as a student and other students still accomplish the learning objectives and the goals of their programs and what does that mean? And so can we give the students various ways to be able to showcase their ability around the material. I can't say what that's going to look like because each professor, as we know, is going to operate very differently. Each program is going to operate very differently. Once the programs themselves put out the specific guidelines of how they're going to operate, from that point on, we will then engage with whether it's the faculty members that figure out ways in which they can give access to students or if it's the students that reach out. That's how we would handle that. Other than that, we don't really know until this university say what decisions that they're going to make.
Thanks.
Are there any other comments or questions? Tim.
I had a question, and I really appreciate you coming to speak to us, just reminding everyone that graduate students can seek accommodations, because I know it is an underappreciated fact. But I was also curious about our in our role as teaching assistants, how if SDS maybe has any role in helping us better provide accommodations for students in classes we are teaching, or even as instructors of record, can I as an instructor go to SDS and say, I've noticed a student has XYZ thing, can you help me figure out better ways to deliver my material or things like that? That's kind of broad, but hopefully you know the direction I'm headed.
Yes, and the answer is yes, yes, and yes. What I will caution you with, say that you emailed us right now. Just with everything that's going on, I know you guys started the session off with the student death and things like that. It will be really tough for us to get back to you really, really quick. There was a message that went out to faculty that if they're struggling to figure out how to accommodate students during this time, or if you have specific students, you can always come to SDS and reach out to us. I think we can handle this two ways, and it really depends on the department. There are some departments that reach out to me, and then I actually go do trainings for the TAs. If there are a group of TAs that actually want to do training, and I can send you through some activity that's around teaching and things like that to think about the way in which you're teaching, I'm totally up for doing that to think about how the disabled community is being engaged in your class. We can totally do those things. But yes, if you have a specific student that you think you could be helpful for, by all means, reach out. I want to give another caveat to that. I think what's really important about you reaching out, there are going to be some subset of students that don't have access to medical documentation. You as that TA can explain how that student is manifesting within that class, and that might be the information that we can actually utilize to accommodate that student. So a clear-cut example of that would be, say that you give a quiz or you give a test and there's 10 questions on that test. Say that you're working with that student and that student did 5 out of 10 questions and the 5 that they did was actually really good work. What you can then do is come to SDS and say, I don't know if the student has a diagnosis or a disability, but what I can say, the 5 questions that they did do were correct. Maybe they just need extended time. And so those are the ways in which you might be as a TA, be able to engage with students that you see are not struggling, but that haven't reached out to resources. And that way you can use real-time information from your class to help us think through what accommodations might be appropriate for that student. No, that was very long-winded. I just added that last piece on because that's an important role that you guys are playing in that TA space. But I hope that made sense to the question that you asked, Tim.
Definitely. Thank you.
Okay, Becca.
Hi, thank you so much for being here today. I'm going to try and phrase my question in a way that makes sense. I'm a bit limited by some of the confidentiality related. So I've heard of several cases where disciplinary action has had to take place in response to non-compliance with some of the COVID-related requirements. So whether that's not complying with the daily check emails or not attending your testing as frequently as you should, or those kinds of things. And I've seen this apply to both undergrads and graduate students. And in many cases, I think the disciplinary action could have been mitigated a lot earlier had these requirements been more accessible? And I'm wondering if there are ways in which your office is working with the COVID compliance team or even the OJA to fill some of the cracks where some of these students are all of a sudden finding themselves in trouble when they might not have known that accommodations were an option.
Yeah, if students come to us or the JA, or there are times where individuals reach out to our office, one of the things that we're trying to do, depending on what's going on, is figure out how can we give access to students with health conditions to be able to meet the expectations of the testing that's required of them. Does that make sense? And so if we're asking certain individuals that might have mobility concerns or might have other concerns that are non-visible that are still very relevant to why it might be difficult for them to go to get testing on a continuous basis, I'll be the first to say we're not trying to do anything to necessarily remove students for testing, but we are trying to figure out how can we make that testing more accessible for that individual. And depending on what that individual is going through will dictate what kind of accommodation we put in place for that individual so they can access the sites at a pace that works for them and give them access to participate. And that's how I can answer that question's best. Without getting too far into details. But if the JA refers people, if the student comes to us, or if any means it comes to us, and there are some legitimate health reasons of why that person is struggling to meet the requirements of surveillance testing, we will work with them to try to get them access to the surveillance sites.
And so I guess, thank you for answering that. I guess my question is directed more towards, are there ways that your office, and I don't want to put the burden on your office because you're doing a zillion things right now, but are there ways that communications from the university can make it clear that there are times in which accommodations for this type of thing are appropriate? You know, if a student might not even know that there are ways that SDS can help them be creative, and especially for challenges they have that might not be as visible, maybe it's not actually physically getting to the test site, which I think it's a lot easier for a student to, in their mind, justify a need for accommodations. But I think that there's a lot of limiting factors that you're probably seeing. I don't know how to make it so students know that this is something valid.
Yeah, I would ask the question back a little bit and say, where is a space where I can communicate that to students? Because I think students are in various pockets, but if there's a platform where we need to communicate that if students are struggling to meet their surveillance requirement, we can try to figure out accommodations to give them access to meet those requirements. Whether that's me writing a couple sentences, whether that's figuring out, but if there's some specific pockets of ways in which you want me to send that information, we can. I will circle back just to mention it to Campus Compact and the JA just to see if we can have some synergy around that, but still just outside of those systems, if there's other pockets where you think I need to touch bases or send communication, I'm willing to do that as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I don't know the answer to that, but I think my suggestion would be the compliance enforcement, whatever their acronym is, that team, whether this is part of their general communication or whether this is part of the communication when a student fails to comply for X number of times or an X number of days, maybe being able to suggest that that's an option or something to get the ball rolling. I've seen several students just fall through the cracks that I don't think it is necessarily their fault.
Point well taken. I jotted down some notes and I'll make sure I look into it.
Thank you.
No problem.
Okay, Mardik?
Hi, my next question is kind of unrelated to the previous questions, but just from personal experience, I have noted that oftentimes there are accommodations made, but these accommodations are at the expense of grad students. For instance, in my case, I need a disability parking pass, and I had to pay a huge sum of money from my own pocket in order to avail that, to the point that it's not sustainable long term and it's really a hassle. Also, in a lot of cases, that was one example. In a lot of cases, my colleagues have asked for things like standing desk or like smaller accommodations to mitigate like chronic health problems, but then either the department or their advisors don't have the funding associated with it. So can the SDS help with those kind of issues which require grad students to pay out of their own pocket for better working conditions?
It really depends. There are certain things that we do have the ability to pay for, but it depends on, is it necessary for you to access lab or research or do your work? I think when we get into parking passes and things like that, there's things that are considered more personal that SDS cannot specifically pay for and things like that. And so it really will specifically depend. I know the parking pass is one of the things that SDS will not pay for. But if there's other things that engage with your program in a way that you need that to have access, then we might be able to pay for some of those things. I can't blanketly say yes to any and everything. It's on a case-by-case basis. But I think if it's in doubt, that might be something to explore. Say that you work with your chair, you work with your department, and they say, hey, we can't afford this. It might be worth your while to at least explore accommodations through SDS. I can't guarantee that we can, but I would at least say explore it, because there are times where we do pay for things for students depending on what that actual accommodation need actually is.
Okay, and Becca, do you have another question? Okay, seems like Kavya has a question. Kavya has a question in the chat. It says, can the Access Fund pay for some of these accommodations?
I mean, that's a question of the graduate school, so I didn't want to ask that as
well. Oh, okay.
But just, yeah.
To my knowledge, yes, there are times where the Access Fund can help pay for certain things. I don't want to speak for the Access Fund just because I don't oversee it. There are times where it becomes a slippery slope and they might reach out and say, hey, a student reached out for this. Can we actually pay for it? And depending on what it is, I can still encourage them to pay for it, even if I can't necessarily approve the accommodation. And that's where it becomes a slippery slope with some of that stuff, because if we are paying, doesn't that automatically mean we're approving the accommodations? For example, a student might need help paying for things for what they would consider trying to get approved for an ESA, for an example. And I wouldn't stop the Access Fund for paying for that stuff, but I can't guarantee that they're going to go through the accommodation process and get that accommodation approved. Does that make sense? I think in those situations, I take a stance that if you have the ability to pay for it, for the student, pay for it with the understanding they still need to engage in the accommodation process. And that's just kind of how I handle it. If it's something that we can't pay for, that we still need to help a student if they have an economic problems with still not necessarily approving it, because that's a different process. So I just want to be clear on those things when it comes to payment. It really depends.
Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, I think seeing none, I think we'll probably wrap up this segment of the presentations now. Thank you so much, Zebediah, for coming today. We really appreciate everything you've had to offer us.
Yeah. Not a problem. And then I'll just leave with, if you're in doubt, reach out to SDS and let us try to help. Thank you guys for allowing me in this space.
Thank you very much. Okay, so our next presentation for today is the Center for Teaching Innovation. So I'm not sure who the individual is representing today. If you could speak up if you're here.
Doreen and Sarah are here.
Yes, Doreen. Okay.
Thank you, Kavya. Good evening, everyone. My name is Dorina Samuel, and I'm with the Center for Teaching Innovation. Wonderful to be here. I haven't been at the GPSA meeting for a couple of years, so I was glad to be invited to talk about the grad programming that we offer, and specifically because we have the CTI fellow applications coming up and we've extended them. So we thought this might be a good opportunity for us to bring it to this group because there is all of the departments that are represented here. So I'm going to bring in the fellows that work with me, and specifically Sarah Davis, who's the senior lead fellow. And so she's going to lead the presentation, but we've also got Kavya Krishnan and Jeff P, who are fellows with us. And so they will talk too about some of the programming we offer. So the Center for Teaching Innovation has grad programming available to all grad students and postdocs. And I recognize some of you, so I know that some of you have been involved with things that we've done. And we offer one thing that did come out of in the past couple of years, we've been looking at our grad programming to think about how we really develop our grad students and to make sure that they have the support that they need while they're teaching at Cornell. And so we actually, it was an initiative that the GPSA pushed through, was the TA online orientation. And we were really excited to be able to put that out last year. And that's something that we would like to hear more about and how we can promote it for all TAs. We don't have as many people taking in part of it, but it is an optional resource that departments can use. And I know that some we're going to be talking about that a little bit more. But I wanted to specifically talk about the TA online orientation as an entryway into thinking about professional development and thinking about your teaching at Cornell. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Sarah. Sarah, are you present?
Yep, I am. And if it's okay, I'll just share my screen really briefly. And yes, we've got, actually, I'm going to speak, and then I'm going to ask Kavya and Jeff P., who are both here and part of the GPSA, to talk about their experiences really quickly. Jeff will talk about the TA online orientation course that Dorina just mentioned. One thing that I wanted to highlight is that we have teaching-related workshops, sort of standalone workshops and institutes that are comprised right now of four workshops following along a common theme. And so if you have grad students in your departments interested in working through sort of a series of steps, for example, this semester we're done with our institutes, but we did a course design institute, we did an online teaching institute, and then a teaching portfolio institute to help grad students develop all, you know, various components for their teaching portfolio. We were able to sort of create these learning communities for those efforts. Separately, we have a teaching portfolio program where grad students who are developing teaching portfolios can come for consultation. And then finally, we've got the Graduate Fellows Program, which I'm a part of. I'm the senior lead fellow this year. And as I mentioned, Kavi and Jeff are a part of. And just very quickly, I wanted to post into the chat the link to the CTI website. And then I'm going to share my screen one more time to just show everybody how to navigate to the graduate student resources. So when you sign in, or if you go to this main page, you'll see this screen. Up in the top right corner is a drop-down menu. And under programs, there's another drop-down menu, but if you click on it, there are resources for faculty and instructors, and then graduate students. So if you click on the graduate student link, you can see these different programs that I briefly mentioned. And really, we've got programs at all different levels of engagement. And so, for example, that TA online orientation sort of gets your foot in the door. There's this upside down triangle to sort of help sort of visualize how you can funnel your focus. And I think a really important thing, we've got a couple of fellows who aren't going into teaching, they're actually going into industry, but the skills and tools and communication techniques and even pedagogy, you know, how to engage with others, how to teach and communicate new learning to people. Those are skills that they've been able to develop as teaching fellows. And we've got this teaching fellows program. The applications are due April 26th. And anybody who, a grad student who has taught two semesters at Cornell, is eligible to apply to this program. So we want to spread that and help with recruiting there. But my time is getting short, so I'm going to pass it over to Jeff for a few minutes to talk about online orientation. And then Kavya to talk about how, as a CTI fellow, she's been able to do direct outreach with different departments or with her own department. Stop share. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Tarina. Just for everyone who doesn't know who I am, I'm Jeff. I'm one of the UA representatives, but I also am a CTI teaching fellow. This year, I've been fortunate enough to be a part of the program. In general, the orientation is something that CTI recently implemented as a way to help kind of guide many graduate students who are interested in getting some kind of standardized training in terms of getting a TA, in terms of getting TA training, especially when they're entering their first TA experience, right? And I think that's something that many in GPSA and also the graduate student community had really wanted. And so this is a really good starting point. It's roughly like a 5-hour kind of online coursework that are put into modules so that students have the opportunity to go through them and kind of get a general foundational setting for what are the expectations and responsibilities of being a TA, and as well additional resources, right? Connecting students to CTI if they've never heard of it and what kind of programming is out there. It's kind of a great way to kind of link up if you're interested in specific topics to go into those workshops that Sarah mentioned, or even if you want to invest more time into it, being a fellow yourself. And so I think the orientation is something that we're working on with departments to ensure that this is something that they might be interested in as they take in new TAs every semester. This is something that we've done already so far with some of the departments on campus, but we're hoping that next year that this could be more widely implemented. So keep an eye out for that. I think on that page that Sarah just showed, there's actually a direct link to the orientation, and you can register for that, and then it'll show up on Canvas. Yeah, and as Darina mentioned, that last year we launched the TA online orientation and the teaching guide as resources for all graduate instructors.
And I can just quickly wrap up before people have questions, but I just kind of wanted to mention that for those of you who may not have known me, I'm the VP Coms. I'm also a CTI teaching fellow. And one of the things that I was able to do being a fellow along with one of the other graduate student fellows is offer some of this programming very specific to my own department. So take the Get Set workshops that we offer to all students and tailor it to be department specific, because I know that's one of the biggest issues graduate students have talked about, which is there some departments do very extensive TA training and some do none at all. So this is a really good way to engage with your own department specifically, especially they don't offer this kind of training, and bring some of what's more broad and make it specific to your department. So that's one of the things we're looking at is the Teaching and Learning in the Diverse Classroom, which is an online module offered through CTI, and doing that as a department, as a cohort, and facilitating some of those discussions within our department.
Okay, thank you so much. It is open for discussion. Are there any questions for any of the speakers? I can kind of pose one question real quick. So the people who participate in these workshops are taking advantage of the resources available. Do you find that there is do you find that there's a good representation of different fields across campus that are using, especially for the workshops, using these resources?
I can probably address that. So we do have a fairly good representation. We try and advertise as widely as possible, and this is why we brought this to the GPSA. We want to make sure that everyone's aware of the resources that we have. But we also do advertise through the grad announcements. And so every week we have all of our workshops. When we look at the data, I think we clearly see representation from all the schools and colleges. And especially since we've been able to do it online this past year, we actually have grad students and postdocs from both Weill as well as Cornell Tech. So it seems like we have been able to reach a lot of people through our programming this past year. We would like to get more people involved, and so we'd love to know how we can do that. So if you have any ideas and suggestions, we'd love to hear that.
I will just add, though, it does seem like a lot of it is word of mouth. And so you'll see people sort of, it comes in waves where we've had like a bunch of engineering, you know, or maybe a specific field of engineering or life sciences. And so there seems to be communication happening in the background so that some departments and fields might sometimes be represented more than others throughout the semester.
Okay, Akarsha?
Yeah, hi, thanks for recognizing me, David. So I don't know, I guess I'm wondering if a lot of grad students and even master students might want to complete their education and go into teaching. And my sort of suggestion slash like question is that I know that the CTI fellowship is 2 years long. So a lot of times students come in say a master's program and they're almost done with their first year. And that's when they find out that there's a fellowship that can be applied to. And so is there something that students who are planning to leave in a shorter span of time can do to build up their teaching resume with the resources of CTI?
So just like to clarify, Karsha, that's a great question. It actually is a one-year program. So they can, if they are interested, they can reapply for a second year, but typically a fellow is only in working with us for one academic year. So they certainly can, if they've taught their first year, if they've had two semesters of teaching, they definitely are eligible to apply for the fellowship. And so I hope that they would consider it. In terms of resources, I work really closely with the grad school, and we have collaborations with the Future Faculty Program. So Colleen McClin, who also has a lot of programming for future faculty. So our focus is mostly on supporting the TAs on campus rather than thinking about their future careers. But we do have the Teaching Portfolio Program, and that is helping you to kind of document your experiences at Cornell, reflect on it, and kind of determine what it is that you might want to add to your portfolio. But that's why we work very closely with the grad school in terms of providing support both here and then in terms of thinking about their future careers. Does that kind of answer your question, Akarsha?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Great.
Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, well, I can add just maybe one suggestion before we move on, which is that I think in terms of connecting with people, I know that I believe I was added to the CTI listserv or like mailing list several years ago, I think in virtue of me being a TA through the foreign language program, right? And I'm wondering if there are other ways that people, I mean, how are most people finding, you said CTI, you said it was mostly through word of mouth, but you find that there's a like more likelihood that people will learn about the program by other means, by coming through other programs, or do you have any insights in terms of that?
So we actually don't have a list any longer because the grad school has a very extensive, and they've done a really good job at keeping up with all the grad students. And so that's why we do our announcements through the grad school, which I know the grad school is trying to keep it within limits because a lot of grad students say that it's too long and they're having trouble getting through it. But what we do is we have a flyer that we develop at the beginning of the semester, and we send it out to all the departments. So we send it out to the graduate field assistants and the DGSs as well. So we send it out that way, and we hope that it goes through. We send it out through our fellows and ask them to pass it on to their colleagues as well. So the question is whether we could do it through the GPSA as well. If that's something that we could do, that might be helpful. But it's too tough for us to maintain a TA list because we don't deal with TA appointments. And so we can maybe send it out through people who participate in our programs, but those are just the people who already have heard about us. So how do we get it out to the people who haven't heard about us and the fact that we do provide this kind of support?
Okay, I understand. Yeah. Well, I think just speaking from my position, I think the GPSA could be a very good way for to reach a larger number of people in different fields. So I think we can definitely be in conversation about, you know, using our communication channels as well to help CTI, if that's something that the other GPSA members are, you know, in agreement on. Yeah.
That would be wonderful. So.
Okay. Are there any other questions and comments? Okay, seeing none, I think we'll need to move on now. Thank you so much, everyone from CTI, for coming to our meeting. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah. Okay, our next presentation for today is Drea Darby, representing Diversity Preview Weekend. If you're here, you are recognized.
Sorry, I couldn't find my mute button. Okay. Hello, and thank you for allowing me to speak to you all today about the Diversity Preview Weekend, especially thank you to Martek for reaching out. So I am a PhD candidate in the Department of Entomology, and I am a co-leader for the Diversity Preview Weekend. So I'll speak to you all briefly today about what our program is, its impact, and a little bit about how other programs could think about implementing something similar to what we do. So it may be no surprise to people in this room, but we have an obvious issue with few underrepresented students in graduate programs, not just in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, but I mean across Cornell and also the nation. So Sue Pierre imaged here, she is a grad student in EB, and she noticed during one of the recruitment weekends of just how this blatantly white the representation of the invited students were. And they did this thing where she collected a breakdown of applicants across a decade. And you see this really high disproportionate amount of white students applying and very few relative numbers of underrepresented racial groups, especially like Black and Native Americans. And so this one of the causes, there are multiple things that could lead to this, but they saw that they had very few underrepresented students even applying to their program. So Sue Pierre and Kate McDonald came up with a solution to address this issue in EEB by having a pre-recruitment event. So through this event, they would bring in underrepresented students to preview graduate school at Cornell. And they started planning this type of event in spring of 2016, and they wrote a letter to EEB faculty addressing this issue and using this pre-recruitment event as a solution to help increase numbers of applicants to their program. And they had the first iteration of the Diversity Preview Weekend in spring 2017. So what is DPW? So this program aims to increase the matriculation of URMs to graduate schools. And it does this by closing gaps in access to resources to these students, so resources that they may not have at their own institution. And it also really empowers students to apply to not just institutions like Cornell, but to graduate school overall. And this event is a graduate student-led initiative composed of not just ecology evolutionary biology grad students, but also from grad students from the fields of entomology, as well as those from the School of Integrative Plant Sciences, also known as SIBS. And so the type of students that we see coming through, the demographics of applicants come from various walks of life, from a variety of underrepresented backgrounds. So we have, there's a lot going on in this graph, but over 83% of the participants who come through identify as racial minorities. And in addition to that, over half of our participants, 56%, are first generation low income, as well as people, or first generation, 22% who identify as low income, as well as people who are identify as LGBTQIA+, and identify being a disabled person. And so these stats show to us that we are reaching the targeted groups that we anticipate to reach and hopefully draw them in to apply to our programs. So what the weekend looks like in a non-pandemic scenario. So before COVID, our event was composed of 4 days of workshops, networking and learning, where we would invite upwards of 40 students to come and participate in a series of workshops and networking with faculty and grad students. So we do like a grad school 101 workshop on like, what is grad school? How do you go about the process? As well as providing a workshop on how to interview with faculty. And then once they've done this workshop, then go on to do mock faculty interviews to really practice out those skills that they learn. And some other things that they do, of course, and we could invite them to visit campus and departmental facilities, as well as having really personalized workshops with personal statements, as well as fellowship and CV workshops where participants can submit their materials, such as their CV and personal statements, to get feedback by other grad students on, and for them to then use that for when they eventually apply for grad school. And other things we have during this weekend is research fair, as well as student life talks to give students a feel of what goes on at Cornell, as well as what is life as a Cornell grad student. And also a really important integral part of this weekend, because of the type of mission that we have, is having an open, a closed door discussion of ethnic and cultural identities in STEM. And since the pandemic hit, we had to cancel our DPW 2020 in-person event, which was supposed to be last March, but we were able to bring this to an online platform, which was difficult, but we were able to make it possible where a lot of the things that we would have offered in person, we were able to do in a virtual format with, I would say, very much success in its execution. And so when we're thinking about, okay, so we've executed this, we've had this program going on for 4 years. So what is some of the impacts that we have had, particularly on the students who come through? So we give them a survey before and after they attend the weekend to get a gauge on how much they know about grad school or how they feel about it. So this is just one question that we survey them on. So I believe I have the skills to succeed in graduate school. And so this is pre-DPW data from our surveyed participants. And after they attend the event, you see the shift from being like more neutral to somewhat agreed to having an increase of how much they agree on believing that they have this, the skills to succeed in graduate school. And here I just wanted to share some quotes that we also get from our attendees in the survey of some of the positive impacts that this event has had. So like one attendee saying, just being able to meet diverse students from all backgrounds that were interested in ecology was awesome. I'll be applying to Cornell for grad school, which I had not considered before. And this one final participant saying, I received an NSF DRFP this year and I 100% would not have without the connections I made. So just based off of the participants that we've had that come in and experience our program, having an overall positive impact on these attendees and how it inevitably impacts on what they do when they pursue grad school. So when we're thinking about the positive impact on the attendees, not just on like the empowering feelings they may have, but inevitably where do they go? So this data here is presenting just participants who came through in 2017 and 2018. We've had 102 total attendees. 102 attendees represents 2017 and 2018. And of those attendees, 62 responded, where 29 of them have matriculated into graduate degree programs. Some of the students who do come through the program are maybe earlier in their stage of college, say like a sophomore, so they may not have already applied for grad school. And when we just look at those who have matriculated into graduate degree programs, 8 of them are here at Cornell and 21 are at other institutions. And which speaks to us, like, the one of our goals for this program is not just to increase matriculation of students into our program, but also in our graduate fields overall. And I did want to share, like, one little fun fact with you all. I was a participant in DPW in 2018, and this program, I guess, has a very soft spot in my heart in terms of informing just where I was in that space and how it impacted my trajectory for grad school and being able to envision myself at a school like Cornell. So, which is why I feel very strongly about the importance of programs like this. And so when thinking about our program now, it's a grad student-led initiative within Entomology, EEB, and SIPS. And we have been making waves as co-leaders for this program to try to bring this to the institutional level at the graduate school. So this is a grassroots-led type of program, which is primarily graduate student labor for administration, for programming, for leadership execution. The only thing that isn't done by grad students is in the pre-pandemic times, we'd have an administrative assistant in SIPS who would book hotel flights and hotels and flights, but everything else is done by grad students. And within the year, there have been parallel grad student-led diversity recruitment weekends that have emerged, like that in the neurobiology and behavior program, as well as the newly emerged life sciences diversity recruitment weekend through, like, molecular biology and genetics. And so with these adjacent DPW-like programs coming through, there comes the potential for competition for similar resources, such as funding. And so we've identified that there's some additional institutional level support that is necessary to sustain this program. And through, like, institutional level support that can enable sustainable resources, not just like funding, but also leadership, and as well as having a place where we can all, like, share programming resources so that this institutional knowledge in terms of how the program is run isn't lost because it is passed down from grad student to grad student, since it is grad student run. And also to have this made available to broader programs to participate in, not just life sciences, but having it available in, like, physical sciences and even the humanities as a vision that we have. So as co-leaders have drafted a proposal of institutionalization at the grad school, which we're still waiting for word on how that's progressing. So until we get to a point where we have this type of program at a higher level than just grad students running it at the department level, just kind of thinking of ways of how grad students can advocate for programs like this. So kind of similar to how, like, Sue and Kate McDonald, as well as other grad students in EEB, just getting data from your DGS or your GFAs on statistics on the application, the admission, retention, and even graduation of students from historically underrepresented groups in your field, and using that as leverage to draft a joint letter amongst grad students and even postdocs to your department chair and faculty, highlighting the issues and concerns, as well as why it matters, and using proposed solutions like a pre-recruitment weekend to help address some of these issues in terms of the lack of representation of historically underrepresented groups in our graduate fields. And this is only, this to preface, one type of remedy of the multiple things that leads to students who are not commonly found in these fields, but having one program that can help mitigate some of these issues. So with that, I'm ready to take any questions if you guys have any for me, and thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you, Drea. Are there any questions? Anthony.
Hi, hi, Drea. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Sorry, thanks for the presentation. I am a student from Cornell Tech, which is our campus in New York City. I wanted to ask sort of a general question about, like, How can DPW sort of engage with the Tech Campus, and how can students from the Tech Campus be involved in this initiative? In particular, you know, I've heard stories of people feeling that they were unwelcome as students of color or students of from other marginalized backgrounds in the campus. And I think that, you know, having a further ways for these kind of initiatives to have a presence in this campus would help improve the environment of the area for these students.
Yeah, so we're trying to work on a toolkit of resources that, because we have a lot of people, even like outside of our institution, reaching out to us on how they can implement a similar program within their own fields. And we have in the past have made arrangements to do like one-on-one meetups to talk about, or I guess like you could call it consultations on how to implement a DPW-like program within your field. But we are in the works of trying to have an easy tool for like a list of like, these are the workshops that we do. Here are the materials that we use that we can make available so that programs like yours, like if you want to implement something like this, don't have to start from the ground up creating your own type of programming, as well as having like a, we have like a blanketed skeleton of how we execute this program, as well as like a budget that we approximately have that we have shared with other groups in the past.
Thanks. Do you know where I could find that information?
Yeah, so
or
you could
I just reach out to you.
Yeah, you should just reach out to me. I think my net ID, it's AMD14. I could put it in the chat as well. Yeah, but typically, if there are groups that want to talk to us about how to implement this type of program, we typically recommend that for now, until we have like this tool source made publicly available, to reach out to DPW co-leaders.
Tim?
Oh, you know what? Never mind, actually. Just realized it was answered earlier.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so seeing none, I think we'll move on then. And thank you so much, Shreya, for coming today, and really appreciate all the information that you had to share with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so this ends the presentation segment of today's meeting, and we'll now move on to elections. We only have one vacancy at the moment, which is the Master's At-Large Voting Member. This is for a term which will end at the first meeting of the fall semester. So there's only one meeting in which this would be active, and this is open to any master's student in any field. Would anyone like to nominate someone or nominate yourself?
I'd like to nominate myself.
Okay, so Isabella has nominated herself. Do you care to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Isabella Harnick, and I am a five-year student in the Sloan Program of Healthcare Administration. I'm really passionate about all things Cornell, and I'm really excited to continue to grow. I currently serve on the Dean's Undergraduate Advisory Council as the co-president, where I work closely with Dean Dunafon. I'm really excited to continue on in this light on a master's level, and hopefully look to take on some more leadership opportunities within this organization in the future.
Okay, thank you. Any quick questions for Isabella? Okay, would anyone else like to nominate someone or nominate yourself for master's at large voting member?
Hey, David, can I nominate someone who are not able to attend today's meeting?
That is a good question. My understanding is they have to at least be at the meeting so that they can show that they recognize that they want to run for this position. So I would say no, you should at least be here to be nominated so that we can like see who the person is and ask questions.
Okay, no problem. Thank you. Let me quickly message her and see whether she finished class or not.
Sorry, could I just call a point of order?
Yeah, what's that?
This position is for voting member for the next
meeting.
24 yeah. minutes.
No, it's not.
Have
it's
elections it's, coming up, right? For the next.
No. Meeting. It's this. That's not for this voting member. The master's voting members are elected at the beginning of the fall. So you would have at least till the end of this meeting, and then the next meeting, and then that's it.
Okay.
All right. Would anyone else like to nominate someone? All right, so since we need to move on, I'm going to say that this is a uncontested election, and I'm going to say, is there anyone that would like to object to Isabella being elected by unanimously to this voting member position? Okay, seeing no objections, then I rule that Isabella, you are now hereby unanimously elected to be most Masters at Large voting member. So thank you so much for volunteering. Okay, moving on to the next part of today's meeting, which is new business. We have two resolutions, the first of which is Resolution 16, conducting open elections for voting members for the 2021-22 term, sponsored by Kavya. Kavya, would you care to introduce this resolution?
Sure. I can share my screen too. So just for some background, normally elections for the 14 voting members from each division would happen at this specific meeting. Just because of COVID, because everything's moved online, we just we're having some issues getting people to vote and get people more involved in person as we would have when we were in person. And also, secondly, we're able to, one of the advantages maybe of moving everything online during this year is that more people have been able to engage with the process. So because of both those reasons, just kind of continue that, we wanted to have online voting for the 14 voting members who would represent the divisions of life sciences, humanities, physical sciences, so on and so forth. And so just... because this is kind of in our charter that says we would do it in person at the meeting. We'd like to change that. And just a quick note on procedure, we'd like to send, if this passes, we'd send an email out to all graduate and professional students describing open positions and calling for nominations as soon as tomorrow, if possible. The nomination period would remain open until the 20th. And then we'd have a vote to all graduate and professional students, inviting them to vote for their division voting members at for the next 48 hours, 27th to 29th. And this would be then, their term would begin by the next final GPSA meeting, where they would be asked to come and vote in the committee chairs and the executive members and the other open positions.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second to considering the resolution?
Second.
All right, it's been seconded, and the question is now before the assembly. Is there any discussion?
David, I can't Nick. Raise my hand. Thank you.
Nick, yeah.
Yeah, so the resolution covers 14 voting members. It's three each for A&H and life sciences, four each for physical sciences and social sciences, and one each for masters at large and masters of engineering, which would imply that the point that I raised previously is correct, that Isabella's term will end in 20 minutes. So with that, I just want to ask Kavya for clarification. Does this apply to master's voting positions or does it not? Because based on the current wording, it really does seem like new voting members of all positions will assume their roles at the next meeting.
So I'm going to defer to David on this because my assumption was that you were right. Going off the positions that were voted in last year around the state, like in April at the meeting, it did include a master's at large, but I wasn't sure how many master's at large positions are there and if there is some split in that.
Yeah, hold on a second. I'm pulling up the charter right now real quick. Yeah, so I'm reading under lines 234, master's degree specific members. The two voting members who represent graduate students enrolled in master's degree programs will be elected at the first regularly scheduled meeting of the fall semester. And we're referring to the 14.
That's with the exception of the master's at large position. The master's at large and the master's of engineering positions are elected with these elections. And then the professional schools will do internal elections.
Oh, okay. So, sorry, I misunderstood this. So, all right. So, how about we say, I'm gonna have to check in this because my how we're going to do this if it's for including the master's students. Let's say that it is. I mean, this is a difference of one meeting we're talking about in either case. So. If we want, we can, we're basically choosing to suspend our own charter because we can't really fulfill this particular requirement now. So if we want to include the master's students in this, then we can do that too. But if not, then we could go with the plan of holding that election at the first meeting of the fall semester. But my understanding is that if we don't adopt this resolution at all, then we have to go into division breakout during this meeting so that we can elect voting members for the graduate school divisions. Yeah. Wendy.
Yeah, I actually just wanted to give a point of information. David is correct. In the charter, lines 234 to 237, it does say the two voting members who represent graduate students enrolled in master's degree programs will be elected by GPSA members at the first regularly scheduled meeting of the fall semester. I misunderstood because last elections, in the spring of last year, they actually did include the masters with the other 14 voting members from the divisions.
Okay, so you're saying that even though it was done that way in the past, that it's the charter is correct, at least in what my original interpretation, is that what you said?
Correct, yes.
Okay, is there any further discussion?
Sorry, just a point of clarification for Nick, actually you're right. The 14 members is 3 from Arts and Humanities, 3 from life sciences, 4 from the physical sciences and engineering, and 4 from social sciences. Though the two masters were included last year, and that's what I was looking at, turns out they're not in the 14.
Yep, that makes sense. I was also looking at the last year's email. That's my bad.
Okay, is there any more discussion? Okay, seeing no discussion, then I'm going to call the vote then. So, all those in favor of adopting the resolution, please click yes. And all those opposed, please click the no button. Let's see if I can. Okay, in the opinion of the chair, I see 18 in favor, none against, and that leaves, I think, 6 abstentions. Then the resolution is adopted and we will move forward with this open election procedure for the graduate school voting members. Okay. Let's now move on to the next resolution, which is resolution 17, creating campus aware criteria for byline funded organizations, sponsored by Anthony Poon of PACT. You're recognized now. Yeah.
Thank you. May I share my screen? So this resolution is a resolution for that builds off of a discussion that we had previously in the previous GPSA meeting. This amends Appendix B, which defines eligibility rules for byline funded organizations. To establish criteria that identifies and distinguishes between which campuses a byline organization serves. So this It also further amends this amendment appendix so that to address the fact that tech-based master's students currently receive the funds generated from the student activity fee back to the organization to distribute to groups at that campus, but the obligations of that organization are not very clearly defined. And so this amends it to explicitly identify that organization and remove also Byline funded organizations which do end up serving tech in the future. So this makes several changes. Whereas Cornell has separately established geographical campuses at Cornell Tech, and Appendix B defines eligibility criteria for Byline funded organizations, but does not currently distinguish between which organizations they'll serve. And students at those different campuses cannot realistically attend services from different campuses. This renews Appendix B, adds eligibility criteria for Byline organizations to identify which campuses they serve when applying for Byline funding. Require that that applying for funding means that they have to, currently they have to get petitions from 10% of the entire body. Instead, this amends it to being 10% of the body for which campuses they serve. So if they serve 10% of Ithaca, then they serve 10%, petition must cover 10% of students in Ithaca. Or if they serve both campuses, it must include 10% of students in Ithaca or 10% of students and 10% of students at Tech. Receive funding or receive an exception from the Appropriations Committee. The previous text was that that the organization simply have 4 semesters of funding. This changes it to following the spirit of the text to demonstrate satisfactory accounting practices, but accounts for cases where organizations may have funding from other sources that prevent them from asking for funding from GPSA FC. And then during the renewal process, the amendment adds that campuses which they serve are added to the information provided to the GPSA FC. And then that that the current Byline process for graduate and professional students at Cornell Tech is moved under the GPSAFC section more specifically identify the organizations, which in this case are Cornell Tech Student Government and PhD students at Cornell Tech, the obligations that they must be upheld to, and remove any remove any funding from Byline organizations which serve those Cornell Tech campuses.
Okay, so is there a second to considering the resolution?
Second.
Okay, it's been seconded. And since I did play a role in advising in writing this resolution, I think it would probably be proper for me to relinquish the chair to Nick, if I may, at least for the period of discussing this resolution. So Nick, I'll give the chair to you for now.
All right. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, David. So let's start up a discussion list. Please raise your hand if you have any questions about this. Tim.
Yeah, thank you. I had a question about the petition requiring 10% keeping with the different campuses. I just wanted to clarify, and I might propose an amendment depending on your answer to this question. Did you, when you say 10% across all campuses, do you mean 10% total of the total body across however many campuses are involved? Or did you mean in the example of, say, both Ithaca and Cornell Tech, 10% at Ithaca and additionally 10% at Cornell Tech? Because I want that to be clear, because it feels like the kind of thing that could cause confusion in the future.
Thanks for the question. The intent is to ask for 10% of students to sign a petition at the campuses that the organization claims to serve. So, for example, in the case of Big Red Barn, which claims to if they claim to serve Ithaca, then they would ask to have a petition from 10% of students at Ithaca, graduate and professional students. The current Appendix B doesn't make this distinction, so it requires 10% of students of the entire body, regardless of which campuses are served. This also secondly makes a distinction if you are claiming to serve both campuses, that you must have 10% of the body from both campuses. So you cannot receive all your signatures from one campus as long as the number exceeds the 10% of them combined.
So sorry if I can just follow up. So the intent is 10% of each campus that they are claiming to serve.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. In that case, I would like to propose just a super minor amendment. If you can scroll to where that is. Sorry, thank you. Just changing, I think it's just a tiny bit further down.
Right here.
Just proposing an amendment to change all campuses to, instead of at all campuses, I'm proposing an amendment to change that to each campus. I think it's a little more clear, the intent, and I, like I said, want to avoid confusion in the future.
Okay, so we have an amendment on the floor. So I'm going to ask for any seconds for this amendment.
I'll second the amendment.
Okay, Anthony seconded it. Okay, so now that we have a second, I'm opening it up for discussion. Does anyone want to discuss this specific amendment? Tim, I'm assuming your hand is raised from before.
Yeah, sorry, forgot to put that.
No worries. Okay, seeing no discussion, I am going to approve this by general consent unless anyone is against. So if you are against this amendment, please speak now. Otherwise, we're going with the assumption that everyone is in favor. Okay, seeing none, this amendment has been approved. And now we're back to general discussion of the resolution. Does anyone have any questions or any amendments or any discussion? David.
Yeah, I'll just be real quick. I think, you know, for those of you who may be confused, there's a lot in here, but basically the gist of it is that the PACT is a group which represents Cornell Tech PhD students. And under this arrangement, their student activity fees would be kind of rerouted back to them via PACT, just like it currently is done for master's students, minus some deductions that are made for byline organizations that are already serving tech. So basically they're getting kind of like a refund in a sense, a reimbursement for those funds that would normally go to groups that have no extension or operation at tech, right? So that's the first thing. And the second part is making these specific amendments to the byline application procedures so that it kind of lowers the bar a little bit to make it easier for certain student groups like PAC to seek byline funding in the future, right? And so part of that is like not having to be FC funded necessarily for the entire time, and also having a smaller petition requirement. So I think that in the gist is basically what this is doing. And I just wanted to make sure that's clear.
Do we have anyone else on the speakers list? I have a quick question for Anthony. Anthony, so I noticed that in the last clause, actually the one before the last, the long one that starts with number 6. so it says that funding would be any money that's not used after it's been deducted for contributions to GPSA risk management, et cetera, would go back to Cornell Tech. I guess the question here that I have just is, are we not opening the floodgates here for, say, a field on the Ithaca campus to say, well, we didn't attend many events, can we get our money back as well? Like, how would we necessarily differentiate Cornell Tech from any other field at Ithaca or Geneva that might want to do the same thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. The justification for this is simply that it is physically distinct. So I'm not sure if you would have the same problem of fields in Ithaca being asking for that, like simply because they are realistically able to attend activities in Ithaca. The second thing is that the whole section 503, the whole point item six or so forth, is really just copied over from existing language that is happening as this one right here. So this is really the same language moved into a different section, simply because the current way that Campbell Cornell Tech Master's students, line 323 to 341, works is that it is automatically approved. And so that doesn't significantly change the way that arrangement works. Aside from putting further restrictions on the organizations and the possibility to remove funding that is given to Byline organizations that serve those campuses. Because currently the entirety of it, regardless of whether or not Byline organizations serve tech, is returned to Cornell Tech Master students.
Okay, thank you, Anthony. I'm gonna just briefly pause here and open up the floor for any motions to extend our meeting because we're not gonna be done in 3 minutes.
Yeah, I'll make that motion. I move to extend until, let's say 7:15 to make sure there's enough time for that.
Yeah. Okay, do we have a second for that?
Second.
Is anyone opposed? If you are opposed, unmute yourself and speak up. Okay, seeing none, that is accepted by general consent. Okay, and then I see... Anthony, did you want to respond? No, I'm not sure if I interrupted anyone when I asked for that motion to extend the meeting.
I had finished speaking. I don't know if that addressed your question satisfactorily.
Yeah, definitely. Caroline, I see your hand is up.
So in addition to the physical mm-hmm. distance, a lot of groups now are doing virtual events, and I can see that extending into the future on like a regular basis. So how are you planning on, like, is there any language that defines involvement in those sorts of events?
No, whether an event is virtual or not, I don't think really changes that. The funding that is excluded includes funding that happens for departmental, so ISG, for example, I'm in the IS department. The IS department may have a virtual event that is accessible at Cornell Tech. So that funding is excluded. But also if a Cornell Tech event happens, that might be funded through PACT. I don't think there is any reason that a student from Ithaca is not welcome to that. So insofar as those virtual events are accessible to the broader population, I think that that they are not excluded from this arrangement, if that makes sense.
David.
Yeah, I just wanted to maybe help answer that question and also try to explain that this, what is being proposed here, is a pass-through provision, which is not necessarily going to be permanent. Because the idea, at least, that why this was created for Cornell Tech Master's students, it was supposed to give them a source of funding, at least temporarily, considering that they're a small portion of the total campus, until which time that they could be more eligible for Byline funding, right? And what we're basically doing is we're extending this somewhat temporary, potentially temporary, provision for another cycle. And until which time we can figure out a more permanent solution for how Cornell Tech is treated, and so that it's not just a special case that now we have to implement something similar for everyone. And for the issue of, I think, virtual instruction, or virtual events, So under the current arrangement, the Byline organization would have to declare which campuses that they're operative at. If they could potentially say, because we offer virtual events, we're operative at all campuses. And it would be the responsibility then of the appropriations committee to determine whether that is sufficient for them to say that they're a university-wide organization or whether they're only operating really at one campus. And so, and then, so that determination is really up to the, I think, the appropriations committee under my interpretation.
Yeah.
Okay. Does anyone else have any questions or amendments or would like to propose a motion?
I would like to call the previous question and vote, if I may do that. And I also want to note that although this is an appendix to the charter, normally the charter can only be amended by a very high margin of something like 2/3 of the entire membership. However, it's unclear whether that actually is the case here because this is an appendix which is really necessary for the Byline appropriations to work. So in my opinion, we can pass this by as a resolution under a simple majority, but since you're the chair, you're welcome to judge of that, and I just want to make sure that that's noted.
So in my interpretation, since this constitutes a charter amendment, I'd like to postpone it to the next meeting per Article 10, Section 10.2, lines 454 to 456. But that being said, if people want to vote on it today, you would need a simple majority to overrule my decision to not vote on it today.
So I won't go against that opinion if the other members, I mean, if other members want to object to that, you're welcome to, but I think that it's only important that we need to renew Appendix B in some form, even if we don't make these amendments. And I don't think it has to be done today, but it should be something that we resolve by the next meeting. So if that's the interpretation you'd like to use, then I won't object to it.
Is this not the interpretation that you would have had?
No, my interpretation is that we could pass this today as a simple majority because the appendix I'm considering is something just not part of the charter itself and doesn't have the same rules about how it's amended, how it's renewed or anything like that. So considering that there isn't anything that says by what majority we have to approve this, I'm assuming I would interpret it as if it were just a simple majority and not as a charter amendment, but I won't try to object if you want to go against that.
No, that's fine. Since I'm only temporarily chairing, I'll go with your interpretation. If anyone is opposed to this interpretation, you can also feel free to overrule that with a simple majority, but otherwise David's motion is in order. Do we have a second to calling the question on this resolution today?
Second.
Okay, seeing that we have a second, I'm going to go ahead and clear the reactions first. There we go. And now you may go ahead and vote with the green yes button if you're in favor and the red no if you're against. And if you want to abstain, you can go with the any other emoji I will take. Um, 14 I saw at the peak, and we have one abstention and two abstentions with myself. 14 in favor, 2 abstentions, 0 against. Considering we had 20, how many people present today?
I think it was 25.
Okay, so then this resolution passes. And I'm giving the chairship back to David.
Okay, thank you so much, Nick, for chairing. So we're now gonna move on. We have 10 minutes left. I will now move on to committee updates. The first committee is the executive committee. So Nick, do you have any updates?
Yes, we will have a response from the provost by our next meeting where I will reintroduce Resolution 13 about the ITAP. the executive committee strongly urges people to run for positions in the upcoming elections. Please reach out to us if you're interested in any of our positions. That's about it on my end.
Okay, any questions for Nick? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to communications. Kavya?
Just that I'm going to be sending out a lot of election information. So like David already mentioned, the entire student body will get an email, both to the nomination form and the voting, so please keep an eye out for that. But also on social media and just telling your constituents that elections are happening.
Okay, any questions for Kavya? Okay, seeing none. Operations, Mardik?
None.
Okay. Finance, Caroline?
We have our last meeting, I believe it is May 4th, and we are accepting applications for tier increases, but that's about it.
Okay, any questions for Caroline? Okay, appropriations, Akarsha?
None.
Okay, DISC, Alexandra Pressure?
None.
Okay, faculty teaching, Cody?
Yeah, so I'm back after missing a couple of meetings because of my baby who just showed up. Thank you. So as predicted, I'm a little bit behind on this, but the call for nominations is going out any day now. At that point, we'll just need people to help go through some of the different nomination letters. Things are coming along. So that's it.
Okay, congratulations, Cody. And any questions for Cody? Okay, programming, Casey?
No updates.
Okay. And student advocacy, David Kent?
Nothing special, except we have our next meeting on this Wednesday at 5 p.m., and I'll send out agenda and Zoom link tomorrow.
Okay, any questions for David? Okay, thank you all. That concludes committee updates. We will now move into open forum when anyone member of the community can speak to the GPSA on any subject. Would anyone like to speak now? Nick?
I was hoping to strongly encourage people to actually reach out to each other about running for positions. I think, talking to people and seeing who's interested in what position might help you get some idea of kind of what kind of team you want to form and how you want to choose what you want to run for. It's super important that all of these positions get staffed. They're extremely rewarding and really please do reach out to us. Last year was kind of difficult to staff the GPSA. I mean, we finally staffed the GPSA in our last meeting of this year. But I really hope that that's not the case next year. It's been really great to be in this position, and it's been awesome to get to know everyone. I really do hope that we can find people that would be interested to take over these positions down the line.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. So this is my last full meeting, last meeting where I'll be president from beginning to end, because in our next meeting, we'll be electing a new president. And then by convention, the chair, that position immediately transfers over to that person. So, and I cannot extend my position because I do not expect to be an enrolled student through the end of next year. So there's no possibility, unfortunately, of me running again. But I think that it's really important that someone is able to step up, if not to be president, to be at some position or officer on the executive committee, because I think that's really where we have the greatest influence in terms of the GPSA. It's where you set the direction, where people look up to you. And I think that it'd be really helpful if we can find people to fill these roles by the next meeting so that you have that entire summer to think about what it is you'd like to accomplish in the GPSA and how you want to go about implementing the kind of change that you want to see. You know, starting at the beginning of the fall semester or even like, you know, the second meeting, it's very hard to just start working in the middle of a semester. And so I think that I'd be happy to talk to anyone personally if you're interested, but I think that this has been a really rewarding position. And I think that this is something that anyone has the ability to step up and do if you just have to believe that you can do it. So I just want to make sure that that's also known too.
David, tell them about the gavel.
You also get a special gavel with your name on it as a perk of the position. So if that's not worth it, I don't know what is. So. Okay, is there any further discussion?
I'd like to motion to adjourn.
Okay, is there a second to motion to adjourn?
Second.
All right, it's been seconded. Is there any objection to adjourning at this time? Okay, seeing none, thank you all for coming. This meeting is now adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.